Access number 27807, Mr. Harry Hooper, Reel 9. Now, before we go on, it's we just want to cover a bit more about something we omitted, which was the sort of operational side of training, the actual counter anti-aircraft fire and fighter training that you did at your operational training unit and again at possibly at the heavy conversion unit. Could you just run through what you did and what you learned, things like corkscrew and other sorts of things, before we go on to a typical raid?
Fine. Well, what I omitted earlier on the OTU training and also at the heavy conversion units was the fact that not only were we learning to fly the aircraft, operate as a crew, we had to operate the aircraft on the battlefield, as it were, which meant that we were taught various practices which would best aid us against fighter opposition, night fighters in particular, and flak barrages. So that at OTU, heavy emphasis was put on fighter affiliation exercises. By this I mean that our aircraft, the Wellington in this case, would fly out and we would join up with a fighter, usually a Spitfire from an affiliation unit, and they would make a series of mock attacks from below, from above, from the beam, from dead ahead, and we would try and put into our practice the theory that we'd been taught. We didn't have an instructor with us at any time during these operations. We merely had to sort of put it into practice and learn by doing the damn thing. What this meant was that against night fighters, the RAF had devised the corkscrew. This meant that if the aircraft or the opposing aircraft was spotted coming in from the rear or on the beam or from the rear quarter, the gunner would wait until he thought the enemy aircraft was committed, and then he would call out corkscrew port or corkscrew starboards. This meant that we would turn towards the oncoming aircraft in a very sharp dive, corkscrew down to the left, switch the aircraft over and corkscrew down to the right. Then we would corkscrew upright, and then we would corkscrew up left. The theory being that after that maneuver, one would be back on track and hopefully at height. Now, in practice, of course, with a heavy laden aircraft, you lost a lot more height than you gained. So having completed that maneuver, if you were still there, you still had to gain height, which was a long and tedious process on a heavily laden aircraft. We put this into practice in daylight only. We didn't operate with British night fighters for the reason they thought it would be a bit too dangerous. Bombing training was carried out on bombing ranges at various heights, and usually after early practice or two, we would complete these bombing exercises after the return from long night cross countries. On this range, we would carry 8 small practice bombs, and we would approach the range from probably north, south, east, west, repeat that, or then from the southwest, northeast, other points of the compass, till we dropped 8 bombs, and these would be recorded, their disposition to the target, and reported back to base so that your bombing skills were measured. I think we did fairly well because I had a very experienced bomb aim, and of course we were just practicing. Once we left OTU and were on the heavy conversion units converting to the Lancaster, we did a little of the same. We didn't have the hours. We only had about 20 hours on Lancasters, so that we did perhaps 2 fighter affiliations and perhaps 1 high-level bombing unit, and then it was virtually off you go to the squadron, chaps.
What about evading anti-aircraft fire? Would you use the corkscrew for that as well?
No, we didn't corkscrew. If you saw during daylight anyway, if you came against a sort of barrage that was roughly at your height, then one was advised to slip down 1,000 feet, not up because it was very slow, but go down 1,000 feet, go off track 30 degrees and then come back on track 60 degrees so that one rejoined the track equidistant along it. That was the main method of avoiding flak. At night it would be much more difficult to do that because of the number of aircraft in the stream and the fact that the flak seemed to be at all different heights.
Now, I think the best thing now is to go back to the squadron and to look at a typical raid in every detail you can remember.
Yes.
Right from when would you... We've covered little bits of this material, but let's gather it all together. There's no particular raid you want to deal with.
Not but, really. But
I think if we look at the daylight raids generally, so this is a typical daylight raid over Germany when you started your operational flying. How would you first find out about this? Would this be when you went to the flight office, or would you know before that?
Well, battle order for the day, if there were operations, would be posted both in the messes and at the squadron and at flight offices. One had to report every morning to them, so you quickly learnt that we would be on operations. In the case of a daylight raid, these normally took place in the morning, or they started in the morning, and therefore the battle orders were issued the evening before, so that early calls could be arranged, and the time of briefing would be stated on there, so that one got up, had a quick breakfast, went to the briefing room, and when all the crews were assembled in the briefing room, the various operatives for bombing, gunnery, RT and navigation would have their little spiel to the assembled crews. The CO would talk about the target for the day, or the senior officer who was going on the raid would add his comments. And here one was advised of the flak concentrations or fighter concentrations, what to avoid, and the assembly areas. Of more particular interest during the daylight raids were the assembly of the squadron into its component VICs. This would be a blackboard illustration whereby the aircraft numbers would be shown in VICs, i.e. aircraft KO King would be the lead aircraft of the lead VIC, and KO Roger would be the starboard aircraft of the VIC, and KO Sugar would be the port echelon, and so on till all the VICs of three were shown. And then the manner in which those VICs would come together to form the squadron formation. It was a fairly loose formation, and the official term for it was a gaggle rather than a formation. Having had this explained, the navigators would go off to the nav office, and there they would complete their courses and tracks, the various heights. They would get new wind speeds, the latest wind speeds, and they would plot the whole raid on a chart and start their log. Pilots were told in more detail how they should be formating, not too close, not too wide. And when this was done, one went outside. We drew our parachutes, which were always inspected and in some places repacked after every journey.
Who would inspect and repack?
The parachute packers in the parachute section would inspect these when they were returned. Then we embossed on...
What about now? When are we getting your kit on? What was your flying kit?
We normally kept our flying kit at the flight offices. So what we would do in that case would be get on the buses, and these would drop us off at the various flight offices. There the chaps would put on whatever flying kit they thought was necessary for the particular operation.
What would you wear?
Well, I would wear as little as possible, because I wanted freedom of movement if I had to get out. Freedom of movement, remember, you're strapped in very tightly in a small enclosure, and 6 to 8 hours in that sort of position without being able to get up and walk around and move was quite tedious. So given the temperatures that we were going to fly at, and given that the aircraft had heating, I would probably only wear an outer suit, which was the canvas Sidcot type, on most raids. On some daylight raids, I just flew in my battle dress without any other equipment. The gunners would wrap up much more securely. In fact, they would probably wear their silks and woolen mixture long johns. They would wear the quilted inner suits, and they would wear the big heavy Sidcots. The rear gunner had an electrically heated suit which he could plug in, and hopefully it would work. It's rather like an electric blanket that didn't always work. But the rear gunner was more exposed than any other member to the elements. The perspex in the rear turret was usually removed, that is the rearward part of the perspex, to give better vision for the night against the night sky. Perspex can get dirty, cracked, and unless it's in tip-top condition, it's more difficult to see through at night. Not so bad during the day.
And what about helmet?
Well, we had a leather helmet with earphones zipped into them, with a lead which came down, and this was merely plugged into the intercom system at each station on the aircraft. And apart from the normal crew positions, there were other stations along the aircraft, so that if a crew left one position to go to another and something untoward happened, he could plug in and report back to the skipper. We also had oxygen masks attached to our helmets, and these clipped on. And we, on a night flight, one would wear the oxygen mask from takeoff to landing, whatever the conditions. So one was taped into this damn thing, breathing into it and out of it the whole time. On a daylight, we only put on oxygen at 10,000 feet. This was standard practice in the RAF for daytime flying. You used oxygen above 10,000 feet. So on a typical raid, we'd be on oxygen from 10,000 feet.
Right, so you've gone to the flight office to pick up your flying kit.
Yep.
Oh, escape kit, I should have asked. Did you have one?
What we got were sometimes little packages. For instance, you might have a silk handkerchief with a sort of sketch map, an outline map of Europe on it. We had a whistle which attached to our lapel collar on our battle dress. This wasn't so much an escape outfit, but something you blew to attract attention if you came down in the drink.
Were you given any currency, sweets, things like that, in this kit?
We were not given currency. I don't know if other squadrons gave out currency. We were not given currency. We had a flying ration of a packet of Wrigley's chewing gum, and usually a Tuckney bar of Cadbury's milk chocolate. This was consumed during flight. We'd also carry a flask of coffee, and indeed on some raids, perhaps sandwiches might be prepared to eat on the way back, though I never had them.
What about what they call wakey-wakey pills, which are amphetamine or benzodrine, whatever it is?
This was a touchy situation because, for obvious reasons, I never used them. But I believe some pilots, particularly because of the long period of time strapped into a seat, and at night, on the way back, it was easy to sort of drowse off. And if you fell asleep, you know, this couldn't be very helpful to the rest of the crew. So there were some people who took it. I've never slept very much. I'm normally awake or half awake all night. I've never been called or woken in my life. And so that if I knew I had to get up at 4 a.m., I would be sort of looking at my watch at 3 o'clock and at 3:30 and 3:40 until it was time to get up.
Right, so anything else you do in your... You get your kit from the flight office,
yes,
or the crew room.
One thing on the daylight raids we had, well, even on the night raids, the pilot had a small Mercator's projection chart. Now, this was a simple white chart with the outlines of the coast and the major cities plotted on it, rivers and features, and so that the pilot had a quick reference as to the courses he would be expected to fly and the heights. When plotted on this in very simple forms, the outward tracks and the inward tracks to the target, also at some space on the chart, we would put down the formation for the squadron, and we would number the VICs 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and so on, and we would give the code letters for the particular VIC in which one was flying. So therefore, we would see a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 VICs. And I would illustrate this by putting three dots, meaning aircraft. On the particular VIC in which I was flying, I would note the lead aircraft, if I was not the lead aircraft's code letters, and the code letters of the other aircraft, so that I knew how to pick them up in the air to make the formation correct.
Now, did you have a crew meal, or I mean, I'm talking about breakfast later, but the sort of
well, if it
daytime raid, would there be a meal?
Well, we had breakfast. This was sort of a bacon eggs type of deal. If we had a night op, we didn't get a set meal as such. You could go and have a meal, but I don't think many people wanted to eat before they flew.
Now, so what happens next then? You're in the crew room.
Yep. Well, we, of course, will have had a time to start engines, and we would have had a time to taxi and time to be at the end of the runway.
Now, hang on. So, those are times that were given to you that you need to... So
absolutely, yes. You have to bear in mind that a typical RAF airfield or bomber station of the time would be just mainly farmland with three runways in a triangular position. These would be joined by a perimeter track. Now, the perimeter track wouldn't be a straight line. It would go deviate around the odd farm building, which was still operative, turn corners, and one had to know exactly on the airfield layout where to go before you set off and in which order, because it was important to arrive at the end of the runway in the correct order so that forming up was made more easily.
So what's next? Did you go out to...
Well, I mean, back in the flight offices, we would decide it was time to board the aircraft. We would go out to the aircraft. We'd make a visual, or the skipper and the engineer would make a visual inspection of the exterior of the aircraft, tyres and various ailerons. We'd make sure the pitot head cover was removed.
The
pitot head is the device which feeds air into the airspeed indicator. This is a simple barometric system where it has air forced into the pitot head, comes in and is over pressure against normal barometric. And this is very necessary, but unless you've got an airspeed indicator, it becomes very difficult. During the period of rest, an aircraft will have a small cover attached to this small prong.
So you check that's off.
To make sure that that's off, we'd probably have a chat with the ground staff, ensure they know which order we're going to start the engines in.
Now, what was your relationship like with the ground staff? I mean, did you know who was working on your aircraft? Because you didn't have your own aircraft.
That is right. But you began to know the crews. I mean, we went out in the... often we were out at the flights. We would go out and look at the aircraft, check that if we were flying them that night or during the day, the next day, we would look over the aircraft, talk to the crew who were servicing it. Another thing we checked was the fuel load. You're quite sure that we're fueled up correctly, old boy, and yes, we were. So you've got 1,500 gallons or whatever on.
Was it a good relationship with them? You had to trust them,
yes.
I presume.
Yeah. I must say, I found all ground staff excellent. They worked in the most atrocious conditions. They were always out of doors. You pictures trying to get on the slippery wing of an aircraft to sit astride the engine to take the covers off and to fiddle about with plugs or magnetos or whatever in freezing winds and pouring rain. You can imagine what it was like for them.
So you've done your visual check. You've had a word with the ground crew.
Yep. And some of the crew would have a last cigarette. I have never smoked, so it didn't bother me. And then we would start to board the aircraft.
Now, were there any superstitions amongst either you or amongst the crew?
Well, my crew had no superstitions that I know of. I know some crews had the odd one, and they wore a particular scarf or had a pee against the aircraft wheel before they took off. But as far as I'm aware, my crew just were ordinary types and just got on board without thinking about it.
Now, were you nervous before a raid? You seen yourself?
No, surprisingly not. I never thought that anything would ever happen to me. I hope the crew thought very little would happen to them. I believe that the sort of training we got in the RAF, particularly once we became into the operational areas, was excellent. I followed it to the letter. I didn't know anything about it, so if they knew something, I took it on board. And I still believe that the crews that followed the instructions or the advice they were given had a better chance of survival than those that didn't. I can illustrate.
We'll come to that,
yes.
Probably, I think, naturally.
Yeah.
Now, so what you get in the aircraft, start getting in the aircraft, what now?
Well, we make sure that the air-to-ground switch is switched to air because we need the power internally. And the ground crew will have applied an external power unit for starting the engines. We've got teeny glim lamps along the fuselage. And in the case of a Lancaster, the bomb aimer would be the first person to go along the fuselage because he had further to go, and passing each other was quite difficult. Followed by the pilot and flight engineer, then the navigator, the wireless operator, the mid-upper gunner, and the rear gunner. The getting into the front of the aircraft was quite difficult in heavy, bulky flying clothing. The rear spar was contained just above the bomb bay, but the front spar was a very deep thing, and there was very small clearance over the spar and between the top of the fuselage, so it meant going sort of clambering headfirst through and getting out the other side. And that then you got into the wireless op navigator stations and the pilot's and engineer's position. Although we had small glim lamps in the aircraft, it was very dark. And I would get into the pilot's seat, strap myself in, connect up the RT, connect up my oxygen clip, and then sort of checked through the instruments.
Now, what were you checking?
Well, we would check, firstly, mainly the lights, such as they were in working order, that the control lock, there was an internal control lock on the aircraft. It was rather like the sort of crook lock you get on steering wheels for cars, anti-theft device. We made sure that was off and stowed, and we would check for free movement of the elevators and ailerons, check that the rudder pedals were at the correct distance for one's feet. One could bring them forward or push them back, depending on the length of one's legs. And then we would commence engine start procedure.
Now, what was that?
Well, the engine start procedure was the ground staff guy would have a torch, and the engineer might have a torch, or he could lean out of the window. And on the captain's orders, he would say, start port inner. We normally started our port inner engine first, then we would go over to the starboard inner. The inboard engines ran most of the units which provided hydraulic, pneumatic and electrical power to the systems in the aircraft. So they were started up first so that we built up pressures and what have you. Then we go to port outer or and starboard outer. The ground staff previously, prior to starting the engines, would have primed the engines through a Kai gas pump. They would prime the carburetors, lock the primer pump, stand clear of the aircraft, and then they would make a circular motion with the torch to indicate that you could start winding over the engine. The engineer would press the starter button. The pilot would usually control the throttles, and we advanced the throttle an inch, half an inch to an inch, so it would catch the aircraft if it fired. As the aircraft engines would have been run up sometime during the day, they usually fired first time, and we settled down the aircraft engines to about 1200 revs idling, or just above idling, so that we could warm the oil up. Couldn't open the aircraft engines up before the oil temperatures had reached the standard required. Then we began a run-up of each engine in turn, where we would advance the throttle to 2,650 revs and probably plus 9 boosts. Then we would check the each magneto in turn on each engine to ensure that when you put one magneto off, there wasn't a heavy drop, that both magnetos would work independently and all together without losing revs. You'd move the flaps down to 20 degrees, which would be what we'd have for taxiing and takeoff, and you'd ensure the bomb doors were closed. And we were ready for taxiing and eventual takeoff. There would be a time to taxi, and you would see other aircraft in the locality start to move off on their appointed times, usually about 30 seconds. You didn't look at your watch. The first one would move off, and then you'd watch the others go, and you slotted into your position, wound oneself around the perimeter track to the takeoff point where we would hold. At the end of the runway, there would be a small hut or caravan in which the runway controller would have his very pistols and his red or green Aldous lamps. I might add that one of the most difficult parts of flying heavy aircraft at night from RAF wartime airfields was with hardly any lighting and the meandering sort of perimeter tracks, steering a Lancaster heavily laden round a narrow perimeter track, little wider than the track of the aircraft, was quite difficult. We had a system of glimmer lamps let in either side of the perimeter track. You couldn't see these from the air, but you could see them if you were sort of on the ground. And we had a system where they were blue and amber. On one side we had a blue light and the amber. They were about 200-300 yards apart, and one could just see ahead for perhaps 200-300 yards that there was a one to the left, one to the right, and you steered in the middle. Lancaster had a pneumatic brake system. Each time you pressed the brakes, the lever was on the control column, you wasted a fair amount of air. And you heard this system, you knew that you were using out fast and it was being replaced, so that if you weren't careful, you arrived at the end of the runway and it was difficult to hold the aircraft on the brakes, there being not enough pneumatic power. Anyway, most people got round it. But if an aircraft which was heavily laden, say at 65, 66,000 all up weight, if you put a wheel off the tarmac onto the grass, it sank to the sort of axle, as it were, and then you stopped the whole procedure. No other aircraft could pass, so this was not the done thing.